Let's take a moment and generate our motivation. And have the courage to face the fact that in our lives, everything is not completely wonderful. Not because other people don't do what we want them to do, but because the nature of our mind is dissatisfaction. And to really be able to look at that quite honestly and see how that constant dissatisfaction breeds so many problems in this life, as well as motivates many actions that then bring problems in future lives. And so this constant dissatisfaction is due to craving, that mental factor that resides in our mind that is nourished by ignorance. And so if we want actual peace and happiness, we have to eliminate that craving and thus eliminate the ignorance that supports it. And so for that reason, we listen to the Buddha's teachings to learn how to do that. But freeing our own minds from ignorance and craving is not sufficient, because there's limitless other living beings who suffer in the same way as we do and who have been kind to us. And so just looking out for our own liberation is not really adequate. It's quite limited. So we want to stretch the mind so that it can include the well-being and liberation of each and every sentient being. And thus, our mind is spurred to attain full enlightenment, whereby we can bring that about more easily. So let's generate that motivation for being together this weekend and for sharing the Dharma. That dissatisfied mind is a big one, isn't it? Yeah. Here we live in the most wealthy country on this planet, and still we're dissatisfied. It's quite amazing, isn't it? Yeah. If we have so much and we're still dissatisfied, then what happens in poorer countries? Yeah. And it's interesting because they've done some studies on it, and people are dissatisfied when they compare themselves to the local people with whom they're associated, whoever they consider their group. If you don't know that somebody else has more than you do, you don't tend to get dissatisfied or jealous about it. Yeah? And so I've found very often when I've been in third world countries that people have been very generous, which to me indicates some kind of satisfaction and acceptance of their life, because they aren't so afraid of sharing what they have. Whereas we have so much, but we're always comparing ourselves to people who seem to have more, because our media really emphasizes this thing of the wealthy, and you watch the TV programs. Have you ever noticed how most of them take place in neighborhoods that very few people can afford to live in? Have you noticed that? You know, these houses are just enormous, and how many people actually live in those kind of houses? But we watch this, and then we get dissatisfied because we want it, because somebody else must have it. And so rather than seeing our fortune in terms of people who don't have what we have, we look at what we don't have and become dissatisfied. Okay, so it's not only with material possessions, but it's kind of with every aspect of our life. You know, we don't have enough friends, we aren't well liked enough. No, we could use some more appreciation, some more love and respect from others. No, whatever our profession is, we don't feel like we've really found our niche in it. No matter how much good we're doing, we still feel like our talents are underused, or we haven't found our niche, or something's wrong. Okay. And so when we look in all these different areas of our life, there's this constant dissatisfaction. Yeah. And it seems like it's coming from outside. Why am I dissatisfied? Because I don't have what these people have. But in actual fact, if we look, the dissatisfaction comes from inside. And it comes from this mental factor of craving. You know what it's like to crave? You know? We crave. We want. You know? We not only want, but we make our wants into needs. Yeah? We desire. We lust after. We cling to. We're attached to. You know? So there's all this sticky energy. You know, it's like our whole mind is just sticky bubblegum that wants to glom on to anything and everything that we think we should have to make us happy. And so this dissatisfaction, it creates a lot of mental emotional pain, doesn't it? Yeah, because you know, we're dissatisfied with our intelligence, we're dissatisfied with our athletic ability, we're dissatisfied with our artistic ability, we're dissatisfied with our dharma practice, we're dissatisfied with our career, we're dissatisfied across the board. Yeah. And it seems like if only at things outside of us would change, then we could have some actual satisfaction. Okay. But then we see people who have the things that we think we need in order to be happy, and they're too dissatisfied, aren't they? You know, they want more, they want better, they still don't have good self-esteem. It's the same old, same old. And so that makes us check and look inside and say, is it really from outside that I'm lacking? Or is it this craving inside of me? So even though ignorance is the root of samsara, you know, in terms of the 12 links, ignorance is the first link that spurs us to, you know, have afflicted mental states and create karma. So even though ignorance is the root, when we talk about the Four Noble Truths, the example given of the true origin of dukkha, or unsatisfactory conditions, is craving. You know? So even though craving isn't the root of samsara, it's the thing that keeps samsara going round and around and around and around. Okay? Craving, craving, craving. So we've been talking until now about craving for sense objects. And within sense objects, I'm putting, you know, status and reputation and love and appreciation and, you know, anything that you can find in our desire realm where we have so many objects of desire. Okay, so I'm not meaning just money and possessions, not just tangible things, but also intangible things that we crave, okay, in our desire realm being. But even there's other levels of craving too that keep us in cyclic existence. For example, the craving of the bliss of meditation. And so this kind of craving can spur somebody to attain very deep states of concentration, for example, in the form realm or the formless realms, where you have single-pointed states of samadhi. But there's still craving, okay? Because there's craving for that peace, there's craving for that bliss. And at the time of death, no matter what realm we're born in, whether it's our desire realm or, you know, the form realm or the formless realms, there's still craving for existence in samsara. Yeah. We're very attached even just to the idea of having a self, of there being a real, truly existent me. And so we crave just for that kind of existence of this truly existent me, because at the time of death, we're terrified that the truly existent me is going to cease and go out of existence altogether. Yeah. And that's very scary, because who wants to cease to exist? So instead, we crave and then grasp onto having another rebirth in samsara. Okay? So in terms of the 12 links, you know, we have ignorance at the beginning, which gives rise to mental states that are tainted, which creates the karma. That's the second link of the 12 dependent arising links. And that second link is what influences where we're reborn and what we experience. Okay? But that karma doesn't just ripen out of the blue. Yeah, we create many, many different karmas during our lives. All those karmic seeds are planted on our mind stream. But at the end of life, the eighth link, craving, comes very strongly. Okay? And so craving in that context is not to leave this body, you know, craving for what we have. When that craving increases, it becomes what we call grasping, which is grasping for the next set of five aggregates. In other words, grasping at the next rebirth. When we have craving and grasping at the time of death, that it acts as the water and fertilizer that nourishes some of the previously created karma to ripen. That becomes the tenth link, which is called existence. Okay, and so that's the karma that is just about to ripen into the next existence. Yeah, so this is all going on at death, you know, this incredible craving, which is really embellished with fear, grasping, yeah, and then the existence, the tenth link, which is that karma when it's about to ripen and throw us into another body. And that brings the 11th link, which is birth, and that brings the 12th link, which is aging and death. And so this craving just keeps us going around and around in samsara again and again and again and again. Okay? So it's not just the craving for sense objects, it's just the craving for existence in samsara. It's this incredible attachment to the self, to I and mine, and, you know, and so wanting more aggregates, samsaric aggregates, samsaric aggregates are the body and mind under the influence of ignorance and karma. And so just as they say, be careful what you want because you might get it, we got it, you know, and we got another rebirth within cyclic existence. And then, of course, once we have that rebirth, then all of the other problems start again. Not getting what we want, getting what we want and it not being good enough, being disappointed, being separated from what we like, being criticized, you know, being our trust being betrayed, all these different problems come, okay? And they come simply because we've taken rebirth in samsara. Yeah? So it's not a question of, you know, let's just, you know, tweak my samsara and get a better rebirth next life. Yeah? Because then everything will be hunky-dory. No, because as long as we take rebirth under the influence of ignorance and afflictions and karma, there's no freedom. And all the other problems just start immediately after that. Okay? So, this is the situation we live in. It's a bit kind of shocking and humbling because we don't think of ourselves, our self-image, doesn't include the idea of I'm a being under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma who is propelled to take one rebirth after another under their influence and experience misery because of it. Does your self-image include that idea of yourself? You know, it doesn't. And that shows the incredible depth of our ignorance. You know, it shows how completely out of touch with just even the conventional reality of our situation we are. You know, because we don't even have this idea that I'm under the influence of affliction of karma. Don't even have it. We just kind of, you know, what's your self-image? Well, I'm me. And I'm, you know, this nationality, this religious group, this socioeconomic class, this race, this ethnicity, this religion, this profession, this gender, this sexual orientation. I'm a person who likes granola or a person who doesn't like granola. I'm a person who, you know, likes to have water fights or doesn't like to have water fights. You know, this is our self-image, isn't it? Isn't it? When we think of me, this is what we think of. But we're so narrow, aren't we? So totally narrow and not at all seeing the situation in which we live and in which we've lived from beginningless time. And, you know, rather than just kind of go, well, oh well, you know, doesn't matter, you know, to say, wait a minute, this is something really important about what's happening, and how come I'm so unaware of it? What is it that makes me so unaware of the reality of my existence? Yeah? This is not, you know, kind of something that's inconsequential. It's something that's extremely important. You know? And that's when we begin to see what ignorance means, you know, how ignorance just totally clouds the mind, covers the mind, so we can't see the reality of our situation. And, in fact, ignorance not only covers and obscures the mind, but it makes us grasp at the opposite of what actually exists. Yeah, so it's not just, you know, sitting in a room where you can't see anything. It's sitting in a room where you think you're seeing reality. You know, so you're seeing the opposite of what is actually there. Yeah, that's pretty gross, isn't it? Yeah. So this is you know, something we kind of have to wake up to see the big picture of what's going on in our life. Because if we don't, then we just keep getting born again and again and again and again. Okay? And also, if we do see this as the reality of our life, first of all, we get on track in terms of what the real purpose and meaning of our life is, which is to get out of this mess of cyclic existence and to attain Buddhahood so we can help others get out. But also by having that big view about what our real problem is and what's really important in life, then all the smaller cravings that we have in this life that make us so miserable, we don't have any time and energy for them anymore. So the mind actually becomes more peaceful. Okay? Put it this way. If you think you're going to have an imminent heart attack, does your mind flip out if you get stuck by a needle? No. Okay. If you're not on the threshold of having an heart attack and you get stuck by a needle, does your mind make a big deal about it? Yes. Is getting stuck by a needle really a big thing? No. Okay? So it's a similar thing in our lives. Yeah? When we have this very narrow view of our situation, you know, just thinking that I am this person of this life who wants this and doesn't want that and likes this and doesn't want that, then there's so much dissatisfaction. You know, I'm not tall enough, I'm not short, I'm too tall, I weigh too much, I don't weigh enough, my hair's blonde and I want it to be dark, my hair's dark and I want it to be blonde, my hair's curly and I want it to be straight, and my hair's straight and I want it to be curly, and I wear glasses and I wish I could wear contacts, but I wear contacts but they aren't the right color, you know, and I want to have this kind of job, but I can't find it listed anywhere. And even when I did, I went and interviewed, and I didn't like them. And, you know, I can't find the right partner. I've been looking everywhere. I've gone on all these dating things on the internet. And I've met this person after the other one, after the other one. And none of them really, you know, really make me happy, but I'm so lonely, but I don't really want to live with somebody, but I don't want to live alone, you know, and I want somebody to love me, but only when I want them to love me, the rest of the time I want them to leave me alone so I can do my own hobbies and do what I want, and I don't want them to tell me what to do, and I don't want to have to take care of their moods because they're way too moody. For somebody who's emotionally stable like me. Yeah. And so we, you know, we just go on and on and on. You know, just this incredible dissatisfaction. And yet, you know, and like I said, this all comes because of craving, thinking that all these things are so important. You know, because we have this image of what our perfect life would be. Yeah, do you have some perfect image of what your perfect life would be at any particular stage? You know, what you would look like, who you would be like, where you would live, what kind of job you would have, what kind of social life you have, what kind of hobbies you would have. We all have this image, you know. And of course it changes as we go through different passages in our life, you know, and then you get older, and you know, and first it's, you know, you have this perfect image of, you know, well, I'm this teenager with my skateboard and my, you know, whatever, you know, and you're craving that, and then you get older, and you know, now I'm a 20-something with my job and my relationship, and now I'm a 30-something with my kids, and now I'm a 40-something, you know, with my kids who are a little bit older, but now maybe I can leave them and go do some fun things, and then I'm a 50, 60 something, and then, you know, I want grandbabies, you know. you know, but then when they cry, you give them back to their parents. You know, and so we have this image of this perfect life at different, you know, stages in our life, and then live in total dissatisfaction because it never works out the way our image of what this perfect life wants it to be. And yet, the reality of our life is we're stuck in this bigger problem of being under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, karma, and getting born and born and born again and again and again. Okay? If we focus and train our mind to see this bigger problem, then the smaller problems of this life cease to bother us. They're like getting pricked by a needle. You know, you just don't have any energy for them because you're focused on something that's really important. And so then your day-to-day life here in this life actually goes much more smoothly. You know, you get the promotion or you don't, you're okay. Somebody criticizes you, somebody blames you, it's okay. Somebody bosses you around, somebody praises you, you know. So we cease to crave so much the very small things of this life because we have a bigger framework and we're focused more on cutting the root of the whole problem, which is ignorance and craving. Okay? Getting what I'm talking about? Yeah, and so that's why in the teachings, the you know, when we talk about the three principal aspects of the path, the first one is renunciation, because what renunciation is we're renouncing the misery of cyclic existence, we're renouncing birth in cyclic existence. Okay, but then our mind says, but birth. It's so sweet. I love these little babies. You know, we all celebrate birth, don't we? You know, somebody had a baby. Isn't that wonderful? You know, well, from... yeah, you're not going to be a good dad. And you shouldn't be a dad. you know, from the viewpoint of samsara, a being getting reborn in samsara is not something to go yippee about. Okay? Yeah, when an insect is born, we don't go, oh, how beautiful. You know, there's a baby ant. Yeah. Maybe for puppies we do that. Yeah. And for kitty cats we do that. Yeah. But do you do it, you know, for mice or rats or porcupines? You know, we're not so equanimous when we rejoice about babies, are we? Yeah, it's a baby what? Who lives where? Yeah. So, you know, from the viewpoint of samsara, just taking rebirth is nothing to go yippee about. From the viewpoint of we're in samsara and we want to get out, then having a precious human life is something that's very beneficial and something to be glad about. But just having a regular life, a regular human life, that it can go either way, okay? Because if you have just a regular human life, well, if you use it to create virtue, that's good. But human beings also, we have the ability to create much more negative karma than an animal ever could. Yeah, so if we don't use our human life wisely, we even come out worse than, you know, the baby gopher. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we, you know, when we talk about renunciation, we're really wanting to be free from all of these different rebirths. And it's interesting because when you think about it, oh yes, yes, that makes sense, I want to do that. But then one part of your mind says, but wait a minute, who am I going to be? If I'm not born in samsara anymore, who am I going to be? Yeah? Because we realize that, you know, not taking rebirth in samsara means not having this body and this mind. And so, well, who am I going to be? I need to be somebody. I want to be somebody. That's the craving of existence. That's the one that comes up at the time of death. You know, because we have no idea of any other way that we could possibly be besides being somebody in samsara. You know, that we have no idea of what it would be like to exist without grasping at a truly existent me. Yeah, we have no idea of what that's like. Whereas the reality is that there is no truly existent me, even now. Even now there's not one. The thought of not having one makes us crazy. And makes us want more aggregates, more body and mind, more body and mind, in an attempt, a desperate attempt, to establish our identity, to prove that we really exist there. I exist because I have body and mind. Cling, grasp, crave, okay? So it's interesting when we start, you know, doing these meditations and looking a little bit deeper at them and seeing how the mind can say on one level, oh yeah, renouncing, samsaric suffering, yeah, I'm all for that. Yeah? But renouncing being me? I don't want to do that. I'm me. Even though that me doesn't exist now. Okay? So while there's a conventional self that exists now, there's no truly existent one that exists now. And yet we really want that truly existent one to exist. Yeah? And when we think of having just a nominal self, it's too scary. Who am I going to be if there's just a me that exists by being merely labeled? Yeah, think about that. How do you feel when you say, the I, is merely labeled? What I call me exists just because there's a label and a concept. Doesn't one part of your mind go, hey, wait a minute. I don't exist just because there's a label and a concept. There's a real me here. You got to understand that. Yeah? There's a real me. And it needs to be protected, and it wants what it wants when it wants it. Okay? And there we are, back into ignorance and craving again. Aren't we? So it's so interesting in our attempt, even just to get this first principle aspect of the path. Yeah, to really actually understand what that means and to really get it on some kind of deeper level, it's not quite so easy. Yeah. So this is why we do a lot of analytic meditation on the Lam Rim, because it's this kind of, you know, you hear teachings, you think about them, you meditate on them. It's this that's going to really change the mind and change how we think of ourselves and change what we focus on in our life. Because otherwise we just go through life like that, don't we? Not really thinking about much. It's like people taught us to do this, we do it. People taught us to be that, we be it. You know, we don't think and question a lot about the fundamental reality or nature of our existence. You know, we just kind of go along, go along, go along. And so as a result, we're still in cyclic existence under the influence of ignorance. Okay? So this is something really to think deeply about. Now, and we think about it deeply first in terms of ourselves, okay? Because we have to want to renounce our own samsara. But then we have to even open our eyes and look around more and realize that all the other beings around us, yeah, the puppies, the kitties, the lambs, all those cute babies, and all the other babies, the baby rats, the baby pigs, yeah, the baby gophers, the baby ants, and the baby moths. I know some scientist is going to tell me the moths are born full. You know, a lot of these insects come out whole. You know, when you're born, you're still a baby. Even if you come out whole, you know, adult size, you're still a baby. We're adult size, and we're still baby. in our own way. But, you know, to realize that this is the plight of all these other living beings. It's not just us. Okay? And so we broaden that perspective to include others, and that is love and compassion, and that is, you know, a bigger kind of mind. But then when we really want to help them be free in the same way that we want to help ourselves be free, it's at that time that we generate the bodhicitta and aim for full enlightenment. Okay. So having love and compassion for others is one thing, but bodhicitta is something different. Okay? Because we can have love and compassion for other beings who are caught in samsara, but we don't necessarily have the wish to get involved in freeing them. You know? We would just assume somebody else did that. Yeah. Isn't that why we have government? Shouldn't that fix everything? You know? We always want to give it away to somebody else to fix. Okay, so love and compassion are good, but they're not going to give us the oomph needed to attain Buddhahood so that we can liberate all the living beings. Okay? So that's why we need the bodhicitta. And then, you know, if we're still ignorant, how are we going to liberate other living beings because we can't even liberate ourselves? Yeah. And so, therefore, we need the correct view of reality, and not just the correct intellectual view of reality, but the correct meditative experience of reality. Yeah. And so that's when we get into the wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay, so do you see how we go in the three principal aspects of the path? Yeah, from renunciation to bodhicitta to correct view. But do you also see how when you're generating renunciation, you have to have some element of correct view in there too? Just, you know, or put it this way. The deeper your understanding of the correct view is, the deeper your renunciation is going to be. Okay, and the deeper your renunciation is going to be and the deeper your wisdom is, the deeper your bodhicitta is going to be. Okay, so all these things really rely upon each other, yeah, and interrelate and affect each other quite a lot. Okay, so that's an introduction. Let's pause here and see if you have any questions about that.
It seems like Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a degree of dissatisfaction that can help to actually be beneficial to be dissatisfied with some sorrow. Or is that not beneficial?
Okay.
Either?
Okay, so being dissatisfied with samsara. Yeah, isn't that a kind of beneficial dissatisfaction? I would say so. Yes. You know, it's like a lot of these emotions or words, we can say that there's one that's one part that, or one type of it that's evolved with craving and clinging and ignorance, and another aspect or another mental factor that shares some qualities with it that could be involved with wisdom. So if we look at, you know, dissatisfaction because I don't have the right relationship and dissatisfaction with samsara, they both share the quality of not having what we want. Okay? So probably on the basis of that, we call them both dissatisfaction. But dissatisfaction because you don't have the right relationship is very different from dissatisfaction with samsara, isn't it? Because dissatisfaction with samsara is coming from wisdom. Yeah. And it's coming from an understanding of what causes happiness and what causes suffering. And so wanting actual happiness for yourself. Whereas dissatisfaction because you don't have the right relationship is not coming from understanding the causes of happiness and suffering. It's coming from ignorance regarding the causes of happiness and suffering. And so it's leading us into, you know, thicker and thicker confusion.
I just noticed that with patients I find the same thing, where mm-hmm. there's a point where I feel like I'm entirely too patient with myself and my progress along the path, where I feel like I've practiced an excess of patience, uh-huh. and there's a degree of impatience called for. And it seems like a lot of these negative emotions, I find the same. There's a touch of it that's still.
Yeah. Okay. So here you're talking about patience. We can have patience for people who harm us, and we can have patience with samsara. Mm-hmm. Patience with samsara is rotten. It's not the kind of patience we should have. Patience with other sentient beings is the kind we should have. They share the similar quality in kind of being accepting and tolerant. Yeah. But they're also very dissimilar because, again, one has the understanding of the causes of happiness and suffering and the other doesn't. Okay. So sometimes we might say patience for this and patience for that, as if it's kind of the same, you know, mental factor, because it does share some aspect. But in another way, and this is how we can see that things are merely labeled, patience for other sentient beings is patience. Okay? Patience with samsara in Buddhism is called laziness. Okay? If we want to be impatient with samsara, okay, we don't want to be impatient with sentient beings. Okay, but impatience with samsara is called joyous effort. Okay, in the same way that dissatisfaction with samsara is called renunciation. So in one way, I'm here just talking about words and labels. We can give one word and say it has a negative aspect and a positive aspect. Or we could give two different words. Yeah. But just to be aware of that because, like you said, in terms of being patient with our samsara, we're way too patient. You know, just we loll around, it's all okay. And, you know, and we really need some energy, don't we? Yeah, we need some joyous effort to do something about the situation. Yeah.
I had a question about, I think earlier you referred to craving as an input factor.
Yeah.
And so my question is, are all of the 12 things, could they be considered mental factors? Mm. And can you undo them all? And do they have to be undone, like in the order that they appear? And is that through the analytical and placement meditation.
Okay, let's take it one at a time. Are all the 12 links of dependent arising mental factors? No.
No.
Okay. There's three that are afflictions, two that are karma, and seven that are results. Okay. Now, depending upon the philosophical school, the karma sometimes is called a mental factor. Yeah. But the three afflictions are definitely mental factors. Three afflictions are ignorance, craving, and grasping. The two karmas are the karma that you create under the influence of ignorance, and then the karma that's ripening due to craving and grasping. Mm-hmm. And then the seven results, you know, in the short form are birth and then aging and death, but then in the long form we have consciousness, name and form, six sense sources, contact and feeling also. Okay? Then the second question was?
Do you need to undo the mental factors to kind of get out of samsara,
okay,
and do the meditation stuff together?
Okay, so do we have to undo the 12 links, actually? Yeah, in order. We have to, yes, we have to uncut the 12 links in order to get out of samsara. Okay. And do you have to cut them in order?
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, by cutting ignorance, then the rest of them get stopped. Okay. Because if you cut ignorance, then there's no karma, then there's no consciousness, then there's no name and form, on and on and on. Okay? Yeah. So that's the chief way to cut them. There's some other interesting ways in which we practice too, like between the link of feeling and the link of craving, to practice there, not letting feeling give rise to craving. Because in our ordinary life, this is how we create so much karma. We have a pleasant feeling, and so we crave for more of it. We have an unpleasant feeling, we crave to be free of it. We have a neutral feeling, and we just crave for it not to end. Okay? And so in that way, yeah, we generate the different kinds of karma. Yeah? Okay. So that's also one point where we really want to stop, is between feeling and craving. Yeah?
Before, you mentioned, you used some words that I've never heard before, and it was really helpful. So that more than just an intellectual sort of correct view, we also need the correct meditative experience of reality. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, is there more than one way to generate that correct meditative experience of reality, or is there just one way? And if so, if it's just one way, what is it?
Okay. So, is there one way to generate the correct meditative experience of reality, or is there more than one way? And if there's one way, what is it? And this actually fits into the third part of Cheryl's question, which was, do you undo the 12 links through placement and stabilizing meditation? Okay? So, or through stabilizing and analytic meditation, sorry. So, yes, you undo it through, you know, stabilizing and analytic meditation. And from the viewpoint of your question, yes, you know, both those kinds of meditations are necessary in order to cut the root of samsara. So it's not just a thing of sitting there waiting for reality to dawn on us. Because reality is here right now. Emptiness, it imbues our whole existence, but we're totally blind to it. So it's not a thing of just sitting there waiting for emptiness to appear in our mind. Yeah. But rather we have to create the kind of mind that has the ability to perceive emptiness directly. And we create that kind of mind through stabilizing meditation and analytic meditation. Stabilizing meditation falls on the side of shamatha or serenity, and analytic meditation falls on the side of vipassana or special insight. Okay? And so we practice those two, you know, the serenity and the special insight, and we try and unify them on the object, which is the emptiness of inherent existence. Okay? So we have to understand what the emptiness of inherent existence is in order to perceive it. Yeah? And so this is where hearing teachings comes in and discussing the teachings comes in, so that we first gain a correct conceptual idea of what emptiness is. And then in our meditative practice, through those two kinds of meditation and unifying them, then we go beyond the conceptual into the non-conceptual. Okay? So it's not just, you know, sitting here and, you know, staring at a stone waiting for emptiness and reality to shine forth in the mind. Yeah, that's not going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Just thinking of the use of words you were talking about. You know, one way of looking at it is a positive, like using the words renunciation, mm-hmm. and the determination to be free.
Mm-hmm.
That subtle distinction for me and other things are really, really important, because mm-hmm. I came with preconception of what renunciation was from a more Western or Catholic point of view or whatever. And so hearing that for a long time and then kind of hearing it in the determination to be free, it turns that in a way, at least to the way my mind was conditioned. Mm-hmm. And I find that's true with a lot of uncovering Buddhism or some of those things. We hear the words, or like when you know, some of those words, you just say, well, we can't translate them into English. We're mm-hmm. going to leave them in a Sanskrit or a Tibetan, because I have so many preconceptions of those that I never really even get close to the meaning.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's why the choice of, you know, what you're saying is that the English words that we choose to translate Buddhist terms are very important, because we don't come with a fresh mind. We come with layers of understanding and reaction to certain words. So the term Nejung in Tibetan, which means translated literally, it means definite emergence. Now, does that mean anything to you? Definite, or you should definitely emerge. You know, it's kind of like pull my head out of the bathtub, you know, or with a snorkel on, definitely emerge. You know what? Yeah. So then we don't have a good English word. So we might say renunciation, in the sense that renunciation, you're leaving behind something. But when we come from certain backgrounds, for us, renunciation seems like pain, because we think we're renouncing pleasure, because we were taught that pleasure is bad and happiness is bad and the body's evil, and, you know, and renunciation means you suffer by giving up everything you like. And who wants that? You know? Okay, so we bring that whole meaning to the word renunciation. Even when Buddhist teachers tell us renunciation doesn't mean that, it means renouncing suffering. Because if somebody says, do you want to give up misery? We say, you bet. Yeah. But when we hear renunciation, we think of getting misery, not giving it up. Okay? when we say that sometimes, you know, that term has also been translated as the determination to be free. You know, well, the word free in Western culture, we all love freedom, don't we? All you say is free. Free means I can get it without paying. Free means I can do whatever I want. I like freedom, you know, and free, determination to be free, yippee. Okay, so yeah, I want to determine to be free. Yeah. Yeah, and so it does, it's very true. The terms, you know, have a big effect on our mind. Yeah, and so we constantly have to look beyond just the meaning, you know, our own meaning of the terms, to the deeper meaning. And, you know, we have a special challenge in this, in that we're translating it, you know, from other languages. But also, even in the other languages, there, you know, you have to change your mind to in terms of how you think about it. Because, for example, we use the word self-grasping. Yeah. Yeah, or grasping at a self. Well, grasping is something like your hand does, isn't it? I'm grasping the cup, I'm grasping the bell, I'm grasping the clock, okay? But that's just a physical motion. What our mind does isn't anything physical, okay? So it we're just using a word that applies to physical things to talk about something that's similar that the mind does. But in another way, the mind grasping something and the hand grasping something are very, very different. Okay? So even if you use the word grasping, you know, let's say in Tibetan, you know, you're still stuck with that thing if, you know, you have to think, well, what does it mean for my mind to grasp? Because we haven't thought about that very much, have we? Yeah, what does it mean for my mind to grasp?
Misery.
Yeah. But how do we know our mind is grasping? Can we even identify grasping when it's in our mind? You know? Yeah, I don't know about you, but grasping so often is in my mind. I just miss it. I don't really get what it means for the mind to grasp that true existence. Or even the term true existence. You know? What does that mean? Even in Tibetan, you know? Dhampa Drupa. People go, huh, whoa, what's that mean? You know? True existence. Yeah, I truly exist. I'm here. Well, no, it means something different than that. Yeah?
I was just thinking with the question you're just asking about, we even realized when our mind is grasping. And what I just thought about, when the mind is like really blatantly grasping, like when you're like really hooked onto something, and we're just like, and feeling really miserable, like, I have to have it, I have to, like, that kind of grasping feels like that eventually you can identify, but it seems like there's a lot of subtle grasping.
Yeah, well, there's the very gross grasping at objects of in the desire realm, you know. I want that piece of chocolate cake, you know. I want another cigarette. I want a drink. I want sex, I want this, I want that, I want this, I want that, okay? That's very, very gross grasping, okay? Very, very gross. But what we aren't aware of, how our mind grasps at the true existence of the things around us and at our own true existence, yeah? That's a much more subtle level of grasping that we've never even questioned before. You know, no matter what religious tradition we grew up in, or even we grew up with no religious tradition, still, our parents make us aware of when we're grasping at sense objects, because we're acting like baby brats, aren't we? You know, how, you know, we're holding on to our toy and going, wah! You know, those little plastic beads, color bead, the big beads, you know, your first bracelet, yeah, and you hold onto those little pink and light blue and yellow beads, you know, okay, so our parents teach us that that kind of grasping is not so good, okay, yeah. As we get older, we change the object of our grasping. It goes from that little, you know, big beaded baby toy to maybe a pacifier, yeah, to maybe a rag doll, to skates, to a skateboard, to, you know, having your tongue pierced, yeah. But so we change the objects, and adults, you know, have craving too. We just change the objects, but we do learn at some point that, you know, too much craving is bad for society because we can't get along with other people when we have too much craving. Okay. Yeah. So we're taught other ways to kind of sublimate our craving. But we're not always even taught that craving is something that makes us miserable. Yeah. It's just don't have too much of it because other people won't like you. Yeah. But, you know, but it's okay if you have some.
So that taps into the other side of the craving of wanting friendship.
Yeah.
It's like one craving balancing the other craving. It's like I want friendship, but I want stuff, but crave that too much and I don't do that, so.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so you have to choose your objects of craving. If you crave material possessions too much, you won't have friends. Yeah. So, you know, we're working with all these different layers of things as we're going along.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just have a little comment that I wanted to share. Just talking about words and getting the definitions and understandings, you know, down. One of the things that I heard recently in a teaching that I heard from Alex Gruzin, he was talking about the practice of requesting inspiration from the gurus and lineage, and he explained that oftentimes we use the word blessings, and he said that he doesn't really like that word. He uses the word inspiration. Mm-hmm. And then you were talking really about getting the right meditative experience, and what he did was he literally translated the Tibetan word for inspiration, which was literally translated as waves of brightening. And this really helped.
Waves of what?
Of brightening.
Brightening.
And somehow this really helped. Like, this was just a different sense of what it would feel like to be inspired. Waves of brightening. So I don't know, just to hear the different meanings of the different words can be really helpful.
Yeah.
To get a sense of what the meditative experience is, you know, meant to be like. What yeah. you're looking for.
Right. That's right. The etymology, sometimes studying the etymology of the Sanskrit words, the Tibetan words, the Pali words, it can be quite interesting because it does give us a more some of the more subtle nuances of the meaning of the word. Yeah. Other people have used, you know, instead of waves of brightening, they translate it literally as transforming into magnificence. Yeah. That's what you're requesting, to be transformed into magnificence. But it's by your own effort plus the inspiration of the Buddhas. Okay. Yeah?
I think this thing with samsara and craving of samsara has a lot to do with hope and expectation and faith. And as long as I have an expectation that something's going to work out, then I'm not going to give up on it. And if I don't have a very strong belief that something's going to work out, then I'm very much likely to give up on it, or at least put it on the shelf for a while. Mm-hmm. And so for me, that's really where I sit. Mm-hmm. You know, how much faith do I have in this alternate view of, mm-hmm. that says there's, you know, next life, and that we're managed by karma and not just what we perceive by our senses. And, you know, and how likely is it, you know, can I be good enough in whatever that means to achieve these things that I crave, and how much faith I have in my ability to somehow worm my way into, you know, bliss in this lifetime. And how much do I really, you know, and so that's where, you know, so that's where I sit, you know, on that little thing, you know, and you can just look at me and how I live to see where I am, you know, mentally with all of that. Because if we knew for a fact, you know, if we really, really believe it, you know. And I was thinking of when you were talking about renunciation and being a brought up Catholic, I had a totally different view of renunciation. I mean, I got that view of renunciation, which is, you know, give up your candy for Lent or whatever. But also, you know, when you read the lives of the saints, you realize that they totally got the emptiness of this life. Mm-hmm. And they totally believed in the solidity of heaven and God. Mm-hmm. And so renunciation was no big deal for them because they knew this was short and it was forever. Mm-hmm. And so there's no problem. And they were very blissful in this life, you know. So, and so, you know, like I said, you look at me and how I live and see exactly where my mind is in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, how much faith do I have in this life versus how much faith do I have in the dharma.
Yeah. I think that's a very good point that faith and expectation really play an important role. And if we have faith that and expect to be able to attain something, we put energy into it. And if we don't, then we don't put energy into it. And so it goes exactly on where our priorities are in terms of you know, where we put our energy in our life. And if we feel like, if we have faith that, you know, if I work hard enough, I'll get this and that and the other thing, or if I dress the right way, I'll find this and that and the other thing, then we do that in order to get, you know, we see some kind of cause and effect, we have some kind of faith that it works that way, and we, you know, have some expectation that if we do that, we'll get that result, and also some expectation that that result will make us happy and bring satisfaction. And we're so imbued with the samsaric way of looking at things that to try and switch and say, you know, actually, I'm not going to put my faith in money and possessions and relationships and this stuff because come, come, go, go. And instead, I'm going to put my faith and my expectations in the cause and effect and how it manifests in the spiritual realm. You know, when we don't have any idea of actually, you know, we want nirvana, we want enlightenment, but what in the world is that? Whereas, you know, kind of somebody who has what we want in samsara, we can see with our eyes. Yeah, we don't necessarily see that person's misery, but we have an idea of what it is that they have and we want it. Or we've had some little taste of, you know, chocolate cake, so we want a bigger piece. But in terms of, you know, the non-tangible things and the spiritual things, you know, especially at the beginning of the path, we haven't had any taste of what it means to have a quiet mind. Yeah, and so having some faith and expectation that it's actually possible to have a quiet mind, or that it's possible to have a loving and accepting mind, or it's possible to have a mind that lets go and is relaxed and isn't craving and grasping and clinging. We don't have any experience with that. So it really requires some kind of faith at the beginning. You know, at the beginning, you know, sometimes what it is you see somebody like His Holiness, and then you say, oh, something special about that person. I want to be like them. I don't really know what it is, but something is there. And he's willing to share how he got there with me, so yeah, I want to listen. So sometimes it's the inspiration of seeing another person. Yeah. Or sometimes it's some experience that we might have ourselves that might just not last very long, but at least it's like, whoa, you mean I'm capable of experiencing that? Yeah, so we have to reorient our faith and expectation, not only about what the goal is, but about the cause and effect that we need process to, in order to get there. And then, like you say, according to where we have our faith and expectations, it manifests in the choices we make in our life and how we live. And so, you know, I think that's why His Holiness really wants us to do the analytic meditations on the Lam Rim, because it's those that really help us to reorient our mind in a different direction.
Because, you know, our life is not like the Mario Brothers, you know, or a computer game. You know, computer games are designed to keep playing the game. Mm-hmm. And so it molds itself. So if we're very bad at it, it makes it easier for us to gain a certain... So it manages us with this level of reward. Mm-hmm. And it responds to us very carefully to keep us playing the game by rewarding us just enough to keep going. And in our jobs, it's the same thing. Our boss rewards us just enough to keep us going, mm-hmm. you know. And so for me, I have to keep looking at the Dharma and saying, you know, what's keeping me going here?
Yeah.
Because if I don't do that, mm-hmm. then the karma to practice the Dharma goes away.
Yeah.
And it's happened to me before in my life. And so it's like, it's very important to me that when I feel it like fading away, I say, mm-hmm. what, you know, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You know, we're, you know, remembering, like you said, remembering I have the capability of feeling this. Mm-hmm. It's great, but it's
yeah. Yeah. It's important. You know, we need that inspiration in our lives. Yeah. Especially, I mean, understanding, like she said, you know, playing a computer game, you're rewarded enough to keep you playing. And the rat's pecking the thing, you're rewarded enough to keep you pecking. And our job's giving, our boss is giving us enough of something so that we keep working. Yeah. But in Dharma practice, we don't always get that, you know, in the way we want it, at the time we want it. And there's nobody to complain to. I mean, you can complain to your boss, but when you're not getting what you want out of your practice, who are you going to complain to? You know, Buddha. Well, Buddha's going to say, hey, you know, practice, then you might get some result. Yeah? So it requires a certain amount of fortitude, you know, and it requires, like you said, having... touching base frequently with our source of inspiration, you know, of what it is that I want to become and what are the qualities that I know I have in the form of, you know, seeds or sprouts now that I want to grow to become big trees and with fruit and flowers. And, you know, what are those, and to remember them and get in touch with them frequently, because that is what will keep us going on the path. Yeah, and so, you know, we have to make that part of our practice. It isn't that, you know, every day we have this blissful, smooth meditation and feel great. You know, sometimes meditation is just, blah. Yeah. But, so there's two things. One is to have faith in the method. Yeah. And so you have faith in the method. You see somebody like His Holiness, this is how he practiced. This is how I can practice and do it. Or you've seen some change in yourself through that practice, so you have more faith in the method because you've had some result, even though not the complete one. So you remind yourself of that again and again. Yeah. But keeping ourselves focused on both the path and the goal. Yeah. As well as having a correct understanding of where we are right now, the base, is important. Yeah. Yeah, because like you said, if we don't do that, then sometimes we get to this point in our Dharma practice of, you know, I've been meditating and bliss and void is really void. My mind is void of bliss and void. So, you know, let's fill it with a sitcom, and we turn on the TV.
So you have been doing this for 30-something years, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you've stuck with it. And got any words of wisdom?
So how have I stuck with it? I I think two things. One is there is some level of understanding, even though not very thorough, that ignorance, anger, and attachment cause suffering. And that was one of the first understandings I got at my first Dharma course. And when you have even some understanding of that, it doesn't give you much out. Yeah? Because as soon as you try and blame somebody, you realize you can't. You know, as soon as you try and fix outside, you realize you can't, that it comes back here. So I think that was one, that's one thing. That's the stick part of it. Then the carrot part of it is what I find the idea of having bodhicitta so inspiring, you know. I have no bodhicitta, but to me the idea of bodhicitta, yeah, to me it's just like so inspiring. Wow, what an incredible way. It would be so incredible to think that way, you know, that just when I think about bodhicitta, then my mind feels very uplifted and very inspired. And so that's the carrot part, you know, I want to be like that. So, and there are people that are like that, so it's possible to get there.
Yeah, well, I thought that was one of the things about Buddhism that is so great, is that our saints are still among us.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's holiness or Kishidango.
Yeah.
You just see, wow, really fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So you can see people who are living examples of the path. Yeah. And that's very inspiring, because then we can become like them.
Well, you got interrupted or changed. You said you must touch in daily with what inspires you, and there are two things. One is you have to have faith in the method, and then we can get
the result.
Okay.
As well as being grounded in the basis. Because we always talk about basis, path, and result. Okay, let's sit quietly for a couple of minutes, dedicate.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.